The way Iowans consume news has changed a lot since the coronavirus pandemic hit in 2020. But people here still need to know what's going on in the state every day. What are leaders saying?
The virus isn't going away until we have a vaccine.
How are medical professionals reacting, and how is it affecting hospital staff and schools?
Those weekends where you are on the phone and sending emails and, you know, dealing with people with a very emotional issue has been really hard.
I'm Clay Masters. In 2021, Iowa Public Radio is starting a podcast called Here First. It's a quick daily show for your work week that catches you up on state news as you begin your day. Get analysis from IPR's team of reporters.
Most of the improvement in the unemployment picture comes from more than 90,000 Iowans no longer looking for work.
Find out when high-profile politicians are in the state.
Back at the state fair!
Learn about what's going on in state government and discover Iowans you might not hear about otherwise.
This is the first time I've spoken with a woman without documents who's also unafraid of sharing her story on the radio.
Subscribe to Iowa Public Radio's Here First wherever you get your podcasts.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The pandemic has made our lives more digital than ever. It's accelerated the nature of our human connections into a more virtual world, moved our social networks even faster into this digital age. Over the past 15 years, my guest this half hour, sociologist Marissa King, has studied how we connect with each other. She's researched how our social networks evolve, what they look like, and why that matters. Her latest book is titled Social Chemistry, Decoding the Patterns of Human Connection. Marissa King, welcome to our program.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
You are a professor of organizational behavior at the Yale School of Management. You teach a popular course, I hear, on networks. So we're going to talk a little bit about your research here in decoding the patterns of human connection. Also, how the pandemic, of course, has impacted our social networks. I understand you wrote this book before the pandemic, Before we have you share those, give us a general overview, if you would, of what you set out to do in this book.
Yeah, the book really is focusing on how to help people understand their social networks and their social interaction. And far too often, when people hear the term social networks, they often think of networking or social media. But in reality, we all have networks. They're the enduring traces of our social interaction, from the stranger you bump into at the coffee shop to your more enduring connections with friends, family, and colleagues. Your networks and the quality of those connections have extraordinary implications for your health, your happiness, your well-being, and your professional success. So my goal in the book was really to help people understand what strength lies in their existing social relationships and how they can harness that to help them meet their needs.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we'll dig into that in just a moment, but let's talk about the pandemic. What are the major changes you see as a well-known researcher on social connections that have been happening in the nearly year of this pandemic?
Yeah, my colleagues and I have mapped hundreds of individuals' networks both before the pandemic and then in June of this year in the midst of lockdown. And we've seen some pretty dramatic changes in people's networks. One of the most striking changes has been we've seen an overall reduction in network size. If you think about the outer layer of your social acquaintances, the number of acquaintances that you have, networks have shrunk by close to 17% or 250 people. But what's particularly striking is almost all of that shrinkage is due to the reduction in the size of men's networks. Men's networks have shrunk by close to 30%, while women's networks have hardly shrank at all. And this is somewhat surprising, right? If we think about all the news that we've heard about the challenges that women are facing in the workplace, the negative hits they're taking on so many fronts, the fact that women's networks haven't shrunk, but men's are, is particularly powerful. And I think it's also deeply instructive about networks in general.
Okay, let's talk about that shrinkage and then about the gender difference here. What are the consequences of your networks shrinking? I'm picturing, as you say, that sort of circles around any of us that go out, and the more intimate connections, perhaps closer in circles and then wider ones, and these have all shrunken. What are the consequences of that, do you think?
If we think about our networks, as you said, as a series of concentric circles, you can think about your innermost core, your closest 2 to 5 connections, the people you rely on in crisis, as being at the heart of your network, right? And this shrinkage is really at this outer, farthermost layer, the people that you wouldn't necessarily reach out to, but you'd be happy if you saw them. And the reason that we've seen this shrinkage is actually that people's time and attention and focus has been on the core of their network, that our networks have in many ways constricted to focus on this inner ring of social support. And in many ways, this is highly adaptive and highly beneficial. We found in our own research that if people who had 5 or more close, very close social contacts haven't experienced any more loneliness during the pandemic, and they've actually fared quite well. Mm. So this shrinkage is in many ways adaptive because we are forced to make trade-offs about how we spend our time. We can either invest our time maintaining these deep social connections or spending time with acquaintances. And so this adaptive focus in the short run is really helpful. On the downside, the consequences of that is if you're looking for a job or you need new information, you're going to have a harder time finding it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting because I'm lining that up with my own experience, and it really maps that way. I have a smaller, more intense communication with the people in my closest circle. And that's very interesting. Let's talk about the gender differences here. Why should men's social networks shrink more than women's in this case?
Yeah, there are a couple of key reasons for doing this. I think the finding first and foremost highlights, irrespective of gender, that our networks aren't determined by how much time we're spending on them. So it's not that women are spending more time maintaining their social connections. There's actually more time crunch than men. So it's not that they're spending more time doing it. The difference really arises for 2 important reasons. One is that men and women actually maintain their social relationships quite differently. Robin Dunbar, for instance, has done a study, and he found that men tend to maintain their social connections by doing things with other people. They may go bowling together, they may go fishing together, they may go hiking together, they may go to the bar together. They can maintain relationships by doing things together. In contrast, women tend to maintain their social ties through conversation. Mm-hmm. And since conversations have been able to continue, but sort of joint activities haven't, women's networks have actually fared quite well. And the final piece of this is actually women are much better at reading their networks than men. If you ask a woman to recall what their network looks like and what its size is, she's much more accurate. Women tend to be much more accurate in doing this than men. And in part, this is thought to be because women naturally tend to be more empathetic and attuned to social relationships than men. So that's not a ding on men, but a call actually for them to be more reflective about their relationships, and particularly during this time when our relationships are so important.
Mm-hmm. You point out in your book that women's networks are more segmented, I think is the word you use. Is that what you mean by what you've just explained?
Women's networks is a slightly different phenomenon. So women actually tend to keep their home lives and their work lives separate. That's beneficial in that it we know from research, helps promote more work-life balance. But it also means that you have to spend more time maintaining relationships because you both have a network essentially at work and a network at home. Mm-hmm. One of the other interesting things during the pandemic is men in many ways have been forced into this similar situation that women have been in for a long time. So men's networks have actually become more segmented during the pandemic. So there's benefits to that segmentation in terms of creativity or innovation, but there are also drawbacks in that it actually can be cause a lot of emotional distress about, like, am I working now or am I maintaining my relationships with friends right now? And so that joint attention is difficult for everyone. And I think that that's become heightened for men in particular during the pandemic.
Right. And many more people now are working in part or entirely from home. So you talk about these spheres, our work and our home social networks have been forced to merge to some degree. What are the implications you see of mixing work and home social chemistry, to take a phrase from your title of your book?
Yeah, I think people naturally have a predisposition to how much they enjoy this. So some people tend to naturally integrate their home and work lives. If you go to their office, back when we had offices, you would see pictures of their kids or their family.
Yep.
They tend to live closer to the office. Other people naturally tend to resist this level of integration. So they often have longer commutes. They may have separate calendars. And so it's for those people that naturally have this preference for keeping it apart, this has become a really really emotionally difficult. So managing those transitions and keeping those boundaries is really important, particularly for people who prefer this natural segmentation. But it's also been really challenging, I think, for people who have actually enjoyed the pandemic. One of the biggest issues is that people who this blurring is making people work longer. And so I think the challenge for everyone, whether you like it or not, is figuring out how do you keep those boundaries in place and how do you maintain the relationships that you do find fulfilling at work when much of the time we're just focusing on work and not able to actually have those more casual interactions that it can oftentimes really be deeply fulfilling.
Mm-hmm. And what are your answers at this time to the questions you just posed there? It seems like we have some hot hazards there if we don't think about boundaries as our home and our work networks are kind of at least spatially merge. What do we need to watch out for?
Yeah, at an individual level, one of the most powerful things you can do is create routines to try to keep some of those boundaries in place. So you may not be commuting to the office, but if you can muster it at least one or two days out of the week, actually like take a shower and get dressed and have a physical workspace that's separate from your home in whatever way that you can demarcate that. So trying to keep some of these boundaries that allow for more psychological transitions to happen is really important. But it's also, I think one of the other pieces is that's so challenging right now is that people are losing their sense of purpose and their sense of connection to their work. And in part, that's because we oftentimes find that sense of purpose and connection through our colleagues. So making sure that you're actually taking the time to connect one-on-one with colleagues, just simply asking and checking in, hey, how are you doing? Mm-hmm. And connecting in a level of humanness and realizing that we're all experiencing a lot of challenges right now can help you maintain the relationships that are so important, both at a personal and a professional level.
Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us, my guest this half hour, sociologist Marissa King, she's a well-known researcher in this area on social connections. Her latest book, Social Chemistry, Decoding the Patterns of Human Connection. She's a professor of organizational behavior at the Yale School of Management. So we're talking about some of the research in her new book, Decoding the Patterns of Human Connection, also how our pandemic has impacted our social networks. You mentioned, and we know this to be true, there are people who have enjoyed, we call it a big silver lining for some people, would say, it's hard to say. There's probably a problem with people actually admitting that they enjoy a pandemic. It is horrible in so many ways, and yet you use the word enjoy, and we do know this to be true. Anybody knows this to be true. There are some people who have enjoyed what about it?
I think that it's given us an opportunity to focus on the things that are most important to us. If for people who've had this experience, so and particularly with respect to work, there's some types of work in which that is deeply actually, it's much more effective when it's done in isolation. So for a programmer would be a great example of this. And so actually having an opportunity to do work without the distractions that often come time with working within office, I think has been beneficial to many people. And as we start to think about what post-pandemic life looks like, I think one of the challenges and also opportunities for organizations and managers is to think about how can we accommodate this and how can we do it well? There's certain types of work that are just more conducive. And there are also certain types of people that thrive in smaller networks with fewer mm-hmm. social interactions and deeper connections. So realizing that there's not necessarily a one-size-fits-all way of either arranging work or arranging our social lives is going to be one of the biggest opportunities post-pandemic to think about how can we create organizations in a society that really accommodates people with a wide variety of preferences about the way that they mm-hmm. prefer to have social interaction.
Okay, so managers, after this is all over, smart managers will take away some of the things that you just said and say, hey, wait a minute, we had this experiment, a forced experiment in isolating ourselves more while we work. What do we keep in the new world where there isn't a pandemic? And you're saying that a lot of this will stick.
It definitely, there's no question it'll stick. And I think the question is, how can we do it well? And one of the things that I think has been a big change during the pandemic is that we now realize just how important our social relationships are. And there's an opportunity there to think more carefully about how we design organizations and also just design our lives to harness social relationships in a more fulfilling way. And one of the biggest examples of this, right, is in many ways the opposite of the pandemic, thinking about open office spaces. So for a long time, offices routinely built open office spaces with the idea that more interaction was better. It was going to help creativity and help create and what we know is actually it reduced productivity and made people much more dissatisfied with work and their relationships at work. So you can think about these two ends of the extreme. And what I think the opportunity is to realize that some people prefer more deeper, meaningful interactions with a fewer set of people. Some people thrive on having lots of interactions with lots of people, and thinking about how we can facilitate interactions that can accommodate both. So rather than just having, for instance, office parties where there's no particular agenda and we're all just kind of showing up hoping that something will happen, how can we think more carefully about social interactions and supporting people with a wide range of preferences?
Right. And this has something to do with multitasking as well. I'm picturing that large room in so many businesses or organizations where there are cubicles, but it's generally open in the architecture. More opportunity, and it depends on your personality, for your train of thought, your concentration to be interrupted, right?
Yeah. And far too often, I think that distraction is one of the biggest impediments to true social connection. There's been great studies actually that have looked at what happens if you randomly assign someone to even just look at their phone, much less have people all around you on the phone, but just simply even looking at your, being told to look at your phone and then having people just simply walking and then ask a clown on a unicycle to cycle by. People, one in four people who are on their phone simply didn't even notice the clown cycling by. So that gives you a sense of just how distracted we can easily be, whether it's through technology or whether it's through people around us. And that distraction has many manifestations. And one of the biggest ones is that joint attention makes it really, really difficult to have quality connections. The quality of our connections are really determined in a moment. And so if we want those high quality interactions that are so important for everything from cognitive function to productivity, we need to be able to reduce the amount of distraction, both in the environment, but also in the task we're being asked to do at any given time.
Marissa King is my guest, a sociologist at the Yale School of Management. Social Chemistry, her latest book, Decoding the Patterns of Human Connection. Marissa, I'd like to have you tell us a little bit about your recent study where you compared loneliness, and this has a real bearing on our pandemic era, loneliness compared in individuals in June of 2019 with individuals in June of 2020. Of course, 2020, you're just a few months into the pandemic. What did you find?
Yeah. We found that loneliness has significantly increased during the pandemic, and this has been true across the board. There are a few people that have been immune to this, and this is people with five or more close connections. But in general, we're seeing rates of loneliness rise. And I think that there are going to be longer term consequences to that that are quite significant that we're already starting to see in terms of mental health. So loneliness oftentimes spends and spills over into things like depression and addiction. So if we can't start to address the loneliness problem that has emerged during the pandemic and oftentimes becomes self-fulfilling and spirals out of control, I think as a society, we're going to have a much longer and bigger challenge about how can we think about mental health post-pandemic, because the consequences are likely to be long-reaching.
Mm-hmm. As a society, we have to rethink that. But what can individuals do being forced into a more isolated situation and feeling tremendous loneliness at this time?
One of the best things that you can do, whether you're experiencing loneliness or just want to be of help, is to realize that there's extraordinary value within your existing social network. So people oftentimes think that the solution to loneliness is meeting new people or how can I go and form new friendships? But actually a much better approach that we know from research is to tap into your existing set of social connections. So this oftentimes can be someone you may not have seen in 2 or 3 years. But one of the most powerful things about our relationships is that the trust and sense of connection endures over long periods of time. Our feelings of closeness might not, but the trust and reciprocity endures. So by thinking about someone that you may not have talked to in 2 or 3 years and reaching out to them, you perform, it's enormously beneficial to you in terms of social support and trust, but also in terms of creativity and spawning new ideas. And people have historically been often reluctant to do this. So they there's if you ask someone to do this, and in my classes, I can frequently make people do this, there's oftentimes a resistance like, oh my God, I haven't talked to them in a long time. There's probably a reason. It's going to be so awkward. And I think one of the benefits of the pandemic is that it's become less awkward. There's been lots of examples of people reaching out and reconnecting during this time. But also, if you are experiencing this, like, how can I do that? Some of the easiest ways are simply to thank someone. Is there someone that helped you out in your life a couple of years ago or early on in your career that you haven't had the opportunity to speak with, and just thank them for what they did for you? Just give them something as simple as, hey, I heard this show on the radio. I thought you might like to hear it. Here's the link. Mm-hmm. Or even asking for help. And asking for help is incredibly powerful for everyone involved because it gives the other person the opportunity to be of service. It gives them a sense of mastery, and it also allows them to get outside of themselves. So by reaching out to others, you can help other people get outside themselves, but also help yourself. And it's really tapping into your existing network where there's already support that's going to help people deal with problems of loneliness more than trying to meet new people.
Mm-hmm. We have just a couple minutes left, but I wanted to have you address anxiety. This is another part of the book that you offer some tips on, because some people have anxiety around meeting new people. And this, of course, impacts the forming of new relationships, your personal network. Talk about quickly, we don't have much time, how anxiety can be a barrier and what you can do about it.
Yeah, I have myself struggled with social anxiety, and so I am really empathetic. And what we know is actually that many people experience this. If you ask people if they're smarter than average, they'll tell you they're smarter than average, they'll tell you they're a better driver than average. But when it comes to social interactions, we far underestimate how good we are at interacting with other people. So studies have shown this time and time again. And one of the best ways to get over this is to realize that social intelligence, like any intelligence, is a learned skill. So by learning really basic ways of interacting, it's easier to interact with an odd number group. If you're trying to figure out who to join at a cocktail party, join an odd number group. There's someone there that needs a conversational partner just because of the way our eyes and our ears work. Follow-up questions are the most powerful question you could possibly ask because it shows you're listening. Mm-hmm. So by starting to understand the basic principles of social interaction and how to use them, the benefits are that, one, it improves the quality of your interactions, but more than that, it just gives you confidence. And it's the confidence that will be critical for helping overcome social anxiety. And then finally, just remember, we all need social connection, especially during this time. So by reaching out to someone, you're actually doing them a favor.
Mm, good point. Good point to leave us with. Marissa King, Social Chemistry, her latest book, Decoding the Patterns of Human Connection. Marissa King, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure talking with you.
That's it for today. This program is available as a podcast. Just subscribe to River to River using your favorite podcast app. River to River is produced by Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.